afternoon. You've tuned in to Freedom Advocates edition of the Perspectives Radio Show. My name is Donald Davidson, and I'm your host. Joining me in the studio, a special guest host, is Michael Shaw, and he's going to tell us a little bit about our very special guest that we have today. Michael.
Well, welcome to the Freedom Advocates edition of the Perspectives Radio Show. And as the regular listeners know, our mission is to assess and bring to the public attention the dynamic of Agenda 21 Sustainable Development, the worldwide movement undertaken by 178 nations, including the United States, for the remake of the world and the remake of mankind. Agenda 21 is the most overwhelming initiative ever launched, I'd say, in the history of the world. And after 20 years of implementation, I can report that it is now in every county within America. The general outlines of Agenda 21 include the perspective on private property. Private property is to be abolished, in fact, is being abolished in a step-by-step manner across the country today. And education under the Agenda 21 protocol is to train children to become New World Order citizens. That is, to abandon the American idea that every individual is born with certain unalienable rights which can't be interfered with by government, and that government exists in accordance with a higher law that recognizes this notion. And that notion is to be obliterated in today's schools, and in fact a good job is being done. And the third primary element of sustainable development is to use the use of technology to control and monitor all human action. And our guest today is Catherine Albrecht, who is a excellent, is really the nation's leading spokesperson for how this element of the world movement is advancing. So we're going to meet here shortly. Dr. Catherine Albrecht, the author of the book Spy Chips, and we're going to discuss the monitoring and controlling element of Agenda 21.
Michael, what's her website? Do you know the website offhand?
Well, she has a website called Spy Chips, and do we have Catherine on the line?
Not yet.
Not yet.
The engineers are still working quite diligently.
Okay, we're having some technical issue, I understand.
Yeah,
and getting
calling in, and we can hear, they can't hear us.
Okay.
So we're going to try to do it a different way.
All right, so we're going to continue with our effort to get Catherine Albrecht, but in the interim, I'll talk a bit more about sustainable development as we prepare for Catherine's appearance. A couple of interesting side notes to the Agenda 21 discussion it would include the awakening that is happening across the country to the organization ICLEI. Now, ICLEI is an NGO that means accredited by the United Nations for purposes of implementing Agenda 21. ICLEI is the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. It has contracts. This foreign NGO has contracts with over 600 cities in the United States for purposes of implementing Agenda 21. Somewhat remarkable, you might say. How can cities enter into contracts with foreign political outfits? Well, that'd be a good question, because the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, prohibits precisely that. It says, to begin that section, it says that no state can enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation with a foreign political power. So these actions are patently unconstitutional, give rise to the notion of treasonous activities, and yet it continues in every state in the union. ICLEI has organized an international congress made up of communities from across the country who are members of ICLEI and who vote in what is, in effect, an existent shadow world government. Now you say, well, why do I bring this up on the KSC radio show in the context of today's discussion? Well, I say this. I say Santa Cruz, the city, and the county of Santa Cruz were one of the original members of ICLEI back in the early 90s. This is one of the plot grounds for the creation of the sustainable development prototype, and they've moved a long ways along. You just need to ask landowners that happen to own land that is situated on what they designate as their wildland corridors across the county. If you want information about these wildland corridors, simply go to the Santa Cruz Land Trust. They have sort of taken the job from the planning department in terms of identifying and rallying the public to a thrust to take away the use of properties that are designated on the land use maps as dark blue in color. And this includes probably at least half of the mountains and small sections of land stretching down to the coast. So we can see the Agenda 21 movement, that is the piece-by-piece abolition of private property, proceeding in our own town at a breakneck pace. This is what Santa Cruzans are waking up to, just like people across the country are waking up. Over 50 communities in the last several months have kicked ICLEI out of their community. Now, there's more work for those communities to do to rid their towns and counties of the debilitating Agenda 21 legislative agenda that has been imposed on every county and in few places as thoroughly as is in Santa Cruz County. So understanding how the dynamics are working in our own community for bringing about this new order, where private property has been abandoned, where children are educated to become global citizens, and where all human action can be monitored and controlled through the technological advances that have been made here over the last three decades. Well, Catherine's work in this area has been really focused on the issue of technology, control, and monitoring of human activity. Her book is called Spy Chips, which is a marvelous revelation of how this has come about in the country and who the players are that have made this happen. So I'm certainly pulling for the technical people in the room next door to get our connection with her working.
I don't know if that's going to happen today, Michael, but I do want to remind everyone they are listening to KSCO 1080 on their AM dial, and we are streaming live at KSCO.com. That's KSCO.com.
Well, Catherine, if you can hear me and if you can find a different phone to call in, that is what we need. Apparently, your type of phone cannot be picked up by the technology here. So I'm hoping that Catherine has heard me and will be able to call in. We can conduct our interview. But in the meantime, I'll continue to talk about sustainable development in a broader sense, and we'll proceed. Well, they seem to be making progress. I see smiles in the room next door. Do we have Catherine, Donald?
We do. Hi, Michael. It's so good to be on with you today.
Well, it's great to hear you.
I know exactly where you are. I used to live right over the hill on the other side of that hill in San Jose, so right where you're located.
Well, this broadcast extends to San Jose, so all of your neighbors, former neighbors, can hear you live right now.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, there's been a lot going on since you and I last spoke, and you and I have been involved in a lot of different projects and speaking events and documentaries and such. I know you've been up to a whole lot of really important informational activities, and I guess I have too lately.
Well, tell us about your latest work and perhaps maybe give the audience some background in your work and your production of the book Spy Chips and a little bit about who you are and how you've approached this issue that faces us all today.
Absolutely. Well, back in 1999, I was actually living in San Jose when I became a privacy advocate, a consumer advocate. I became annoyed way back when with the Safeway Club Card, which was first being introduced in 98 and 99. And I took it into my own hands to do a little bit of research and figure out what those cards were doing. And I discovered that they were using the cards to make a record of everybody's purchases and linking all of the things that they bought back to the individual who had bought them. Safeway has since gone on now to use those for insurance purposes and health monitoring and all kinds of disturbing things. So people don't realize when they get the 15 cents off a package of rice with their club card, what they're really doing is allowing this giant corporation to capture a really a bird's eye view of the nutrition that their family's receiving. So from there, I went on to Harvard University, where I received a doctorate in 2006 in consumer education and human development. And what I focused on there was, again, the shopper card issue. I asked people if they were aware that their frequent shopper card hanging off their keychain was essentially making a record of all their purchases. We found out that 75% of people said they had no idea that was happening. So it was just a very small minority that even realized what kinds of privacy trade-offs they were making when they scanned those cards. And in 2003, I was doing some research for an article I wrote for the Denver University Law Review on the shopper card. And the research or the article that I wrote wound up being over 40 pages. And it was called Supermarket Cards, Tip of the Retail Surveillance Iceberg. And, of course, you know, if you've studied the Titanic or icebergs, that about 90% of it is underwater, and you just see a little tiny bit floating above the surface. And that really was the case with the frequent shopper card. It's the visible part of a vast network of computers and databases and data collection that retail stores have been deploying against their consumers. And I say against very specifically because they use this in ways to charge us higher prices, and I think they're very anti-consumer practices. But they've been doing this now for well over a decade, coming up on two decades here shortly. And while I was researching that article, I came across a quote by the vice president of AC Nielsen, the consumer research people, and he was saying that there's a new technology on the horizon that will allow market researchers not only to know what people buy, which he said, you know, not only to know what kinds of products are popular and what sorts of people buy them, but to specifically know what each individual in the country is purchasing. And not only that, but it would enable them to know when people are using the things that they buy. And so my ears perked up and went, huh? He said, yeah, first, and this is him writing in this article, he said, first there was the barcode, which enabled the retailers to computerize their inventory and discover what objects were being sold together, what kind of high-ticket items were being sold with low-ticket items, who was profitable, and those sorts of things. And then along came the frequent shopper card in the 90s and the early part of this last decade, which allowed them to know who was buying those items. And he said, but there's a new technology, which is RFID, or radio frequency identification, which we call spy chips, that was poised at that time, 2003, to replace the barcode on individual products that you would buy at, you know, Target, Walmart, wherever you shop, that would actually be trackable home with you, that these tiny radio frequency microchips would transmit information about the consumer and transmit that information even from within their homes when they use the product. So it was a shocking notion to me that they weren't just content with knowing who was buying what and getting that kind of a database, but they actually wanted to spy on us in our own homes, in our own bathrooms, to know every time, as one industry executive put it, every time the consumer takes the lid off the toothpaste in their own bathroom, these market researchers, so that they had a right to know that information. So that's what spawned what has now been over a decade worth of research into radio frequency ID. We wrote a best-selling book. We hit number 6, top 10 bestseller on Amazon.com with our book Spy Chips, myself and my co-author Liz McIntyre, who's a former federal bank examiner. So you had sort of all of my Harvard consumer research training and my background as a consumer advocate fighting against privacy invasion, and then all of her extraordinary investigative skills. And we went through literally thousands of internal documents, patent filings, confidential documents that we uncovered a whole cache of those as to how they were going to try to palm this off on the public as a good thing, and essentially detailing a mortifying world in which every physical object on the planet contains a tiny microchip, just like a miniature cell phone GPS tracking device, if you would, that would enable all of those things to essentially phone home, and they were going to unleash this on us and use it to replace the barcode. So there would be trillions of these little objects all over the planet transmitting their information. So I did that 2003 through about 2010, and in 2010, I actually had started doing my own radio program, which if people would like to check it out, it's KMA, those are my initials, KMAshow.com. So I do my own daily radio program, and I started to become aware that...
That's broadcast on Genesis, is that right?
It is, yeah. It's on Genesis, and we are on over 2 dozen radio stations around the country, so we get picked up and rebroadcast. Maybe KSCO might take a look at my show. We'll see if they have any interest, but the show is picked up and broadcast all over the U.S., and I, in the course of doing that, have interviewed some really fascinating people to try to learn more about different areas of the whole privacy battle. And I have to say, one of the most interesting sets of interviews I did was a couple of years ago. It was actually 2009 when I first became aware of an issue that's very much in the news right now, and that is the whole Google monopoly on information. And what I discovered was that not only is Google making, or have they created, the largest database of personal information ever collected in the history of humanity. They know more about us than the FBI, the CIA, the IRS, all combined. Google knows essentially as much as they can possibly find out about every single one of us. Every person who's ever logged onto the Internet has a file somewhere in the bowels of the Google machinery there. The founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, when asked what they wanted the ultimate search engine to be like, or what they wanted Google to become, their answer was like the mind of God. And they have since gotten their fingers into virtually every information pie there is. And on March 1st, this is the big news, they announced that starting this week, they are consolidating their bird's eye view of each of us into a single database file in their system, which if we're logged into any Google service, whether it's Gmail or YouTube or Picasa, organize your photos, or Google Plus if you're using that for social media, any Google service you log into, especially people with Android phones, because you pretty much have to be logged in to use your Android phone, that gives them by extension, as of March 1st, the right to then collect information about all of the other things that you do using any Google service or landing on any website that runs a Google ad, for example, and put it all into one single centralized database about you. And I got to tell you, that is one of the most chilling things I think I've ever heard. There's no opt-out. There's no option of saying, no, I'd rather not, or where do I check the no thank you box. Everybody who uses a Google service is going to be caught up in this enormous web of data collection. And it started this week.
Well, Catherine, looking at the history of the supermarket dynamic and now looking at the Google dynamic, would you say that this is an advance in marketing sophistication, or is this the entree into total surveillance?
Well, it's kind of interesting, Michael, and the reason I always enjoy talking to you is because you see such a different, bigger picture, and because of the work that you do. So it's a lot of fun to come on your show because you really get it. People have asked me, first let me clarify, I am a Christian, and a lot of the work that I do really, I think, centers on issues of just plain and simple good and evil. I believe it is absolutely, utterly wrong to exert control over other people through watching them and spying on them, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're a Jew. People of all faith traditions have had reason to be very afraid of being spied on and watched in this way. And when you start talking about ultimate issues of good and evil, and why is it that these things are happening, why are these people doing these things, I think you start to get into some metaphysical realms. I mean, I really think it takes on spiritual overtones. Now, I've had people ask me, so, Catherine, you know, we've heard about Bohemian Grove, or we've heard about, you know, the Masons and their weird ceremonies, and we all watched, the Lady Gaga fiascos and the bizarre things that Madonna did at the Super Bowl. Is that all tied in? Are the people creating these systems sitting around lighting black candles and worshiping Lucifer? And the answer to that question, as far as I can tell, is no. They're actually not. They are lusting after the same things that people have lusted after throughout all of history that has led them into a place of sin, you know, which is a lust for power, a lust for control, a lust for money, a lust for fame, a lust for attention. And I think in the case of these market researchers and the marketing companies, I really think it's a lust for knowledge, that they feel themselves entitled to really fundamentally penetrate any kind of wall of privacy that anyone else would like to put up against them. And so I do think that that comes from a dark spiritual place, the need or the desire, that consuming lust to have power over other people. But I don't think it's as overt as, you know, these people are literally participating in black masses or anything. But the end point really is going to be the same. Because once these things get created for greed's sake or simply because they can, I'll give you an example. There was a guy at Harvard who heads up one of their research departments there. And I had this shocking conversation with him. He was saying how great it is that you can use RFID technology to tell every time your cat uses the litter box. And I'm thinking to myself, like, who cares? Like, really, come on. Or his other example, he said, you know, you put a little radio frequency collar on your cat, and you can tell every time your cat, you know, goes in and out of your house. And I thought, well, if I had a cat that was maybe getting lost, I might care. But otherwise, you know, there comes a point where I just really don't need that level of information. So this idea that every physical action that occurs on the globe has to be watched by someone, by some computer somewhere, has to know when the cat goes in or the cat goes out. Or another example, I was at a meeting at MIT. They had a long, interesting story. The guy who heads up the shopper card program at Stop and Shop, which is our biggest East Coast grocery chain out here, was boasting to a bunch of MIT graduate students about how much information they had on their shoppers. And one, among other things, he was telling us that they were looking to share that information with HMOs so that they could have a better view of the health of the members of the HMO based on the kinds of things they were buying at Stop and Shop. You know, if you're buying nothing but Haagen-Dazs and hot dogs, you're probably not going to be as healthy as if you're buying, you know, broccoli and carrot juice. So those kinds of questions were coming up. But as we're in this meeting, you know, and I'm sitting here frantically taking notes. I've crashed a lot of fascinating meetings. But anyways, I'm sitting here frantically taking notes in the back of the room. This one guy who's like the quintessential, to my mind, he like represents this whole sort of spiritual problem. He's you know, a geeky guy, probably 25 years old, and he says, oh, it would be really great if you could wire my refrigerator to become an RFID reader. By the way, that exists out there. Somebody's already created that. But anyway, he's like,
well, that's all part of the smart meter dynamic, which
it is,
we want
totally
to talk about as we move along.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, so your smart meter would tell government authorities whether you have one or, you know, two things of orange juice in your fridge and whether one of them was expired. But anyway, this guy says, it would be so great if I could sit at my computer, and I'm not making this up, Michael, this guy really said this. He said, it would be so great if I could sit at my computer and without having to open the door of my fridge, I would know what was in it by looking online at a database of what was in my refrigerator, and then I'd know what I could make for dinner.
Well, there's some people who have no boundaries to the exposure of themselves as we'll call it a chattel. I mean, some people regard themselves as chattel, and that's the unfortunate thing. Most people don't, but I think the spy chip world that we're entering into will cause us all to become chattel.
Well, and there's really a different kind of a problem too, because I don't know if people have heard of this Google Goggles thing that's being tossed around. People are talking about this new product, Google Goggles, which is this pair of glasses that you can put on where you can view the world essentially through an internet screen, where you would view the world like Terminator. You know, you look at something, and the Google Goggles identifies its outline and knows what it is, and it can log you onto websites so you can buy that thing. You know, again, tying back into what's fueling all of this is money, because they can extract money from us. But even back at MIT, and MIT is such a bizarre place. For people who don't know it, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology is right down the street from Harvard, and I took a bunch of classes at their really cutting-edge, futuristic media lab back before I wised up and realized that wasn't the direction the world should go. But I took some classes there, and I remember back in the 90s, there was this guy, and he was a legend on campus of just weirdness. He had strapped onto his eyeglasses, you know, in front of his face, a visor, which was a camera. And so everything that he looked at would be, he didn't see the sky and the trees. He saw a camera that would take the sky and the trees and project them onto a little screen that he was viewing. So there was literally no purpose to this device. It didn't have access to the Internet. It really didn't do anything other than provide a filter between him and the real world that digitized and made everything into a kind of a movie for him that he could watch. And when he'd have conversations with people, they would be recorded. You know, this little thing was tied up to a data recording device. I don't know how much he was able to record in a day. You know, probably not much with data storage back then. But, you know, this idea of putting something between yourself and the real world, which is really what this guy about the refrigerator was saying. I mean, if I want to know what's in my fridge, I can get up, I can go into my kitchen, open the refrigerator, and look with my own eyeballs and say, ah, here's what's in here. But this guy, and I think it's a kind of an illness, you know, a spiritual illness, this desire to virtualize everything, where I don't want to see real sky, I want to see a sky that looks like a movie, or I want to go into World of Warcraft or a video game and see a fake sky, or I want to log on to a fake fridge on my computer to figure out what I'm going to have for dinner, because this real world, this physical world where we have bodies and we walk around and touch stuff and interact with people, that's just a pain. So, and you can already see this migration, Michael. We're already moving to a point where people's interactions with one another are taking place more in screens than face-to-face. Well, yeah, I don't know how it is in Santa Cruz. I hope it's different there. But you walk into a Starbucks in Harvard Square, and I did this recently. There were 30 people in the Starbucks, approximately. And of those 30 people, they're sitting in groups of two and three at tables. Only two sets of people, so four people out of 30, were actually talking to one another. Everybody else was looking down into a screen.
It seems to me, Catherine, that's an exposure that the individual takes to this technologicizing world. And that's something that we each have to evaluate individually. But I'm concerned about the bigger consequence of the data collection. You know, if the data collection was centralized within multinational corporations and shared with government and agencies, it becomes very easy to use this data to for government to do anything they want. As their power continues to expand, as government authority continues to proliferate, and information is obtained by government through this kind of process, working with their public-private partners, multinational corporations, and other organizations that exist for the purpose of partnering with government. And you know, I can't imagine that Safeway would not partner with government upon the request. We all know that Google partners with government, starting with the Chinese government. And so for us not to think that the bigger risk isn't one where, gee, we happen to fall into this make-believe world and we live a life that's not real, that's a risk for some people, and I understand that, and that's of a concern. But the bigger risk is the societal effects of having this information in the hands of the
well, then you get into issues of freedom. And one of the things that I often say as a privacy advocate is privacy is a means. It's not an end. It's a means. And privacy is a means to freedom. And in the same way, you often hear the phrase knowledge is power. Well, when people have knowledge about you, they have the power to take away your freedoms. So when people fight for privacy, they're usually fighting for something else that's a different, maybe even more deeply held value. And I think what you're referring to here, when we talk about privacy, and I don't want someone recording everything I look up on Google, or I don't want someone reading my email, or I don't want someone with an infrared camera looking through my walls and watching what I do in my home, what we're ultimately talking about is I don't want someone able to exert that kind of power over my life. I want to be independent. I want to be free. I want to have the right and the ability to live my life unmonitored and uncontrolled in that sense. And, you know, most of us, we're going about the private actions of perfectly legal lives. We're not harming anyone or doing anything wrong. And we really do have a right to be left the heck alone as we do that. But increasingly, these technologies are stepping in between us and the actions that we perform, like the Internet, and monitoring us. So let me give you an example, and let me just bring us up to the present, because I was kind of taking us through a timeline of my research. Back in 2009, I was saying I became aware of this whole Google issue, And the fact that every single thing you search for on Google goes into a database with your name at the top. And so they know if you've had, if you've looked up herpes or if you've looked up marriage counseling or if you've looked up drug addiction or if you've looked up bankruptcy or foreclosures or looking for a new job, whatever it might be. All of that, every single search that we perform through Google gets stored and recorded, and Google has it. They know that about us. The way I first figured this out about Google is a couple of years ago, before the big swine flu problem, long before that, actually, Google made a bet with the Centers for Disease Control. It was a kind of an informal boast. And they said, we bet you that based on Google searches, what we know about people searching Google, that we can detect a flu outbreak before the Centers for Disease Control can. Now, the CDC has all kinds of monitoring in place. They have public clinics and doctors reporting and all sorts of things that flow the information into the CDC so they can say, hey, Topeka, Kansas, looks like they're having a flu problem. Let's get some vaccines out there, which is its own problem. But what Google said is, we can beat you. So Google put together a flu map. And on this flu map, what they did was every time you log on to Google, Google gets your IP address, and if you're logged into their Gmail account or their YouTube account, or if you're logged into any Google service, they know specifically and exactly who you are and all the email you've sent and received and everything else. So when you log on, they know that you're logging on from Topeka, and they also know everything about you. And so if you begin to search when you log on for chicken soup recipes, or you look up your company's time off sick leave policy, or you look up Robitussin and blah, 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 they know based on your searches when you have the flu. And they took those. Every time they got one of those, they'd say, oh, we got a live one. Now, this was all automated, of course. But they said, oh, we got a live one in Topeka. Somebody has the flu. And then they'd put a red dot on this flu map. Anyway, long story short, they did this over a period of a couple of weeks, and they sure enough did beat the Centers for Disease Control by, I think it was like a week before the CDC knew that there were outbreaks. Google knew it. And when I looked at that, I said, hang on a second. When we log on to Google to do a search, we are not consenting to take part in their research project. You know, I have to say, as a researcher at Harvard, I had to jump through 10,000 ethical hoops and get all kinds of permission to do any kind of research involving, quote, human subjects. And all I was doing was asking them questions on a questionnaire. And I had to have that go before an institutional review board and an ethics panel and everything else. And they told me that, you know, I have to be very upfront about everything I'm collecting and give people an option to opt out, blah, blah, blah. Well, Google doesn't do that. You think that because you're in a sealed room with the door shut and the shades drawn and you're looking up Robitussin, that nobody knows. And yet Google is recording it and they totally know. Making matters worse, I then looked into Gmail. Everybody out there with a Gmail account needs to know that Google is reading every email that you send or receive. And they're taking the keywords out of it. If you write in an email to a friend, now mail is kind of sacred. We think of it as sealed in an envelope and it's a crime to open it. Not Google Gmail, because if you write to a friend and you say, I'm really looking forward to my vacation in the Caribbean, Google will read that email, stick it into your personal profile, and then use it to serve you ads for the Caribbean. Now, that's bad enough. You may log onto a bowling site, and what do you know? There's an ad for a restaurant in the island nation you're about to visit. How did they know? Well, they know because they read your email. Some people would say, well, that's annoying. It's not pleasant to have somebody reading my email. But, you know, marketing's marketing. Who really cares? Here's where it becomes frightening. Where it becomes frightening is when you take a look at things like the MIAC report. This was the fusion centers. And I took this one really personally. A couple of years ago, there are these law enforcement databases where law enforcement combine information. And somebody leaked one of the reports. It was the Missouri Information Awareness Center report. So it was the MIAC report. And in this report, they identified people who were potential domestic terrorists. And when you read the list, like, sure, I'm with everybody else. I don't want terrorism in my country. But when you looked at that list, the people that the key law enforcement of Missouri had identified as potential domestic terrorist risks were essentially you and me and everybody listening to us. Because what they said is anybody, I'll just cut to the ones that mattered to me. They said anybody who cared about RFID. Well, my gosh, if you understood what RFID could do, the total tracking of spy chips, then you would totally care about that. That doesn't make you a terrorist. It makes you informed. They also said anybody who supported presidential candidate Ron Paul, well, my goodness, you take a look at polls today, he would beat Obama right now if it were a neck-and-neck race between the two of them. So right there, that's a huge swath of the country. They said anybody who cares about the U.S. Constitution, my goodness, I would say that you're a potential domestic terrorist if you don't care about the law of the land you live in. So when I went through this list, and and then one of them was anybody who had seen the film America from Freedom to Fascism, which I have the privilege of saying that not only have I watched it, I'm actually in it. And Aaron Russo, rest his soul, who created that film, was, I believe, one of the most outstanding American patriots who's ever lived. So you look at all of that and you say, hang on a second, so what does that mean then if they think we're potential domestic terrorists because we actually are paying attention to what's going on in our country? By the way, Michael, I didn't see Agenda 21 on there, but I bet you that's on the most recent one.
My interruption of what you're saying is that what you're talking about now is Agenda 21. It evidences the mastery of the monitoring and control aspect of Agenda 21 as part of a bigger picture. The bigger picture is control of the human species, turning us into chattel.
Right.
Abolishing our private property, educating our children so that they become good troopers in this new world order, a new world order which calls for an 85% reduction in writing of the people on the planet. So it is spiritual. It is a matter of monitoring and controlling the information that's known by central forces about each of us. And that's why spy chips is such an important contribution to understanding really the pinch that humanity is in, brought to us by those who have the power and the will to take total control over our beings. Catherine, we're going to have to break for a few minutes for some announcements that Donald wants to make, and we'll come right back.
If you can hold with us, we'll be right back with you, Catherine. And if you've just joined us today, we're here with special guest host Michael Shaw and our very special guest, Catherine Albrecht. Catherine, you have a website that you'd like to put out?
Yeah, I've actually got two, and I didn't get to this, but KMAshow.com is my radio show website. SpyChips.com is all about RFID. And I, for the last 3 years, have been involved in assisting in the development of an alternative to Google called StartPage, which is online at Start, S-T-A-R-T, StartPage.com. And StartPage, I think, since the March 1st Google privacy changes, is pretty much the place people need to be switching to instead of Google, because StartPage does not record your IP address, does not make a record of your searches, any of the things you search for, and in fact doesn't even know that you've been on the website at all. And if there were to be a breach or a subpoena or what have you, and StartPage's servers were accessed, there would be literally nothing there to find, because StartPage's whole business model is not recording what people search for. There are two websites I want to tell people. StartPage returns pure Google results with 100% privacy. StartPage acts as an intermediary for you and retrieves your Google search results and gives them back to you privately. And then if you don't want Google results, but you want the results from all the other search engines minus Google, then there's a website for that as well, and that's IxQuick, IxQuick.com, and I've been involved, as I said, in the development of those search engines for the last 3 years.
Terrific.
Well, thank you, Catherine. What can you tell us about smart meters and how smart meters fit into this data collection mechanism that's unfolding?
Well, smart meters are essentially RFID on steroids in a way, because the whole problem with the RFID vision that I was telling you that these horrifying corporations came up with back in, 2002, 2003 that we detailed in spy chips, is that the read range on these microchipped objects is pretty short. You know, it's anywhere from a couple of inches, 3 feet. In some cases, you might get 15 or 20 feet, but they're not going to be beaming to satellites, and you're not going to have, the pill bottle that that CBS wants to monitor, it's not going to be beaming all the way to, you know, San Francisco. It's going to be only beaming across the room. So the smart meter, the real problem with the smart meter is it is set up to be capable of monitoring your use of not only all your appliances, but potentially down the road to be the portal through which the monitoring of the objects in your home is transmitted out into the world. And so that was the big question that all of these companies kept having is, you know, do we get people to wire their medicine cabinets to the Internet? Like, how do we justify that? Do we get people to wire their refrigerators onto the Internet?
I think those are smart refrigerators. I think that's in process. It's being built, smart refrigerators, smart everything. In fact, I remember 7 or 8 years ago being down in the county building bowels with a little committee they were holding on smart water. And these fellows were gleeful way back then about how the technology was being developed such that your shower use could be monitored and actually managed. In other words, cut your shower back, or your dishwasher would be managed to be able to be run only at certain times. And they were very excited about the prospects for getting water consumption down through smart water circumstances. And I've been reading that smart water is coming.
When you're in Santa Cruz and when you're in San Jose, when you're in California in general, water is a big issue. When you're in Texas, which is one of the places where my show broadcasts, is across Austin and Dallas, Texas, the big thing down there is people's air conditioner use because it's, you know, it's already 80 degrees and it's just March. So by the time the summer rolls around, it's 110 and everybody is cranking away their air conditioners. And the city of Austin actually worked with a power company a while back to issue these smart meter thermostats. And they told apartment owners and homeowners that if you wanted, that they would give you this free $300 digital electronic thermostat. And, you know, it was this fancy high-tech Wizmo gadget. There was just one catch, and that was whenever they had a drain on the power, you know, too many people using the power, that they would have the ability to remotely turn off your air conditioner for 15, 30 minutes at a time, and you would not be able to do anything to bypass it. Well, I've had people on my radio program from Austin who have lived in apartments where they didn't choose it, but their landlord installed these things, and the power doesn't go off for 15 or 30 minutes. The power goes off for a couple of days at a time. They are left sweltering. They have to go to the mall to get relief because it's 115 in the shade, and it's been a disastrous situation. But that was one of the first widespread deployments of this. They used Austin, Texas as kind of a testing ground. And given that it worked, now the thinking is, okay, so how do we get all of these appliances onto the same kind of control mechanism, whether it is allowing them to have remotely controlled radio frequency signal receptors that allow them to be turned off, whether your washer and dryer, and I don't know about you, but I've got like a 15-year-old washer and dryer that I bought used because I hate the new electronic ones. I can't stand them. So mine just has a manual button you push. There's no electronics. There's no fancy gizmos. There's no digital readout or anything. But ultimately, those fancy digital readout devices would have the ability to simply say, hey, I'm using my standard world clock, and I can tell from the satellite that it's between the hours of 8 a.m. and 5 p.m., and I'm just not going to turn on. It doesn't matter how many times you push the start button. I'm not going to turn on because these are peak use hours. And, you know, in exchange for giving you a 10% discount off of your electric bill in allowing us to install these things, voila, you've agreed to it. And the other thing I should point out, you will start seeing discounts associated with these. Safeway, we talked about the shopper card. Safeway has actually offered discounts to its employees on health insurance if the employees would allow them to use the club card information to monitor their eating habits and be part of this sort of healthy eating thing that they're doing. So it's not really a discount, though. Now, this is what we discovered when we started researching the shopper carts. They don't offer you discounts. We actually caught Albertsons and Safeway and other supermarkets taking objects or items, like one of them was Velveeta cheese, that actually said $4.99 on the box. You know, they put the little circle and Kraft says, you know, special, $4.99. And they marked it up to $7. But if you had your club card, you'd get the special discount of $2 off and you'd pay $4.99. So these discounts that they tell you, and it's going to be a huge incentive to try to get people on board with these things. We're talking about the smart refrigerators, the smart electric meters, the smart washing machines. They're going to say, we'll give you a, quote, discount. But what they're really going to do is raise the prices on everybody who doesn't comply and wind up making more money in the long run either way. So be careful when Greeks come bearing gifts, because those discounts, those incentive programs are really nothing more than the ability to avoid a penalty.
Well, and it all adds up to knowing everything about you. And if you think human life is sacred and that yours is your life to live, then you're going to have natural objections to these things. And that's why here in California, Northern California particularly, the public reaction to smart meter installation has been strongly adverse. And yet I'm not sure that many people opposing smart meters understand the ongoing implications of having smart meter on your electric meter, and how that ultimately will tie into every activity that goes on in your household. So it's not just the Google monitoring, it's the smart meter monitoring, and it's the, you know, camera monitoring at the stoplights and on the building walls and the rest of it. We are being prepared, it seems to me, for a condition where the martial law forces are going to have more information and more capacity to control human activity than similar martial law forces in countries in the past. So,
you know, Michael, there's a new report out by the Brookings Institute on exactly that, how within a couple of years the totalitarian and authoritarian regimes of the world will have the ability to know everything at all times. Every conversation that's had, every phone call, every email, every time a vehicle moves, that they'll know it all. And so exactly what you're describing, the Brookings Institute, which is, you know, a think tank that's highly respected, they've come out and said essentially the same thing. So that is the direction that we're going. They acknowledge it. They recognize it. We recognize it. And the real question is, what do we do about it? I want to encourage people to continue to resist the smart meters. I want to encourage people, if you're on Gmail, to really double think whether or think twice. double check. Check with yourself as to whether you really do want Google reading and recording all of your correspondence. And, you know, I really want people to take advantage of the tools that other people have created to make this possible. The smart meter opponents have already set up a movement opposing this. Join them, support them, send them money if they need it. You know, write letters if they ask you to. The folks who have developed, StartPage, for example, you know, make the switch. It's amazing how many people have this Google needle stuck in their arm. They're addicts to Google when they fully recognize how harmful Google is for their liberty and their future. And there are alternatives. There are options out there. And the one thing I want to make available to your listeners, Michael, is we at StartPage actually have a new email program that will be coming out this fall called StartMail, which will be an equivalent to Gmail. With, you know, large accounts, et cetera, but it will be fully encrypted. It will be encrypted on our disk, so we can't even see what your email is, and it will be available coming this fall. So when you delete your emails, they'll be completely deleted. Nobody's going to read them, and it will have all the privacy of postal mail. And if people would like to get on board with that, I'd just like to give out my email address if they want to get on the beta testing list, because we have a limited number of opportunities for people if they would like to get an announcement about it and kick the tires for free when it comes out, that they can just drop me an email. And my email is kma@spychips.com, kma@spychips.com, and they can just put email beta, B-E-T-A, in the subject bar, and I will see if I can get them onto that beta test if they want to get off of Gmail. And see, Michael, that's really the thing. I've been doing this 13 years, and it's so hard when you give people the bad news. They just want to hang their head and cry.
No, that's true.
And you really need to provide, this is how the last couple of years I've said, you know, I've spent so many years telling people what's wrong. Now let me actually spend a couple of years working to try to give them alternatives. So that's how StartPage came about. That's how StartMail is coming about. You know, we're looking into the possibility of developing a private browser that literally won't even accept cookies, or will hold them briefly and then drop them when you're not on that website. Looking at ways of providing DNS lookup that's private. I mean, there's a whole host of services that people need And we're really locked into these big players who are abusing their access to our information. So I think that's really the key, is if we can find ways to provide constructive ways to fight back and constructive alternatives, well, I think that's really the secret.
A beautiful concept. If you could provide us that information at Freedom Advocates, we'll post it to our town crier. And for our listeners today, we thank you for being with us, and thank you so much, Catherine, for the information today and the great work you've done over the years. And for our listeners, tune in to freedomadvocates.org. You want to understand the sustainable development movement in Santa Cruz and across the country and see how people are reacting in various locales throughout the world, really. Visit our website to study up. Know what's happening so that you can begin to take the kinds of steps that Catherine's been talking about here in the last few minutes. And there's so much more that can be done. And until we're with you again, have a good life on this beautiful day on the Central Coast. And we'll look forward to meeting with you soon. Thank you.
All right. And with that, I want to thank our special guest host, Michael Shaw, for having joined us today, and our very special guest here, Catherine Albrecht of SpyChips.com. Is that correct, at SpyChips.com?
Probably KMAShow.com is my most current website, KMAShow.com.
KMAShow.com. All right. Thanks again for joining us today, and I want to thank all of you for having joined us today. My name is Donald Davidson for the Perspectives Radio Show. Thanks again for joining us, and God bless all.
Your source for news, sports, traffic, and weather. AM 1080, KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey.